Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Marie-Luce Storm. She's a Swiss filmmaker over in Bristol for a week, making a film about Geneva, Toulouse and Bristol, looking at gentrification and what she calls metropolitisation. Now that is getting rid of lots of poor people from the city centre. She's hot foot, though, from the Yellow Jackets protests in Toulouse. Also, university lecturer and writer Ron Mendel. He's an expert in international relations, and he gives us some of his views anyway about the Middle East. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
I'm Marie-Luce Storm, and I'm preparing a new film project. So I came to Bristol because Bristol will be one of the places the film will be located, as a city turned into a metropolis. The other city will be Toulouse, and the third one will be Geneva.
So how do you choose these cities? Obviously, you're from Geneva, but so what about the other two?
Well, I quite know Toulouse now, and there is some common points. First, according to the population, it's roughly the same, and also the extent of the town, the fact that there is a river, and that the city grew up along the river, and now the city is growing up more and more outside. There is a phenomenon of gentrification, which is also part of the topic I want to address. And also because in these three cities, there is a movement that is starting to be very organized and very strong against the metropolization.
So what is metropolization, if I can say it? Turning an ordinary city into a metropolis, what does that mean?
It means that the people in the center, living in the center, will be excluded in the outskirts. It means that the center of the city will be renovated, and also with a lot of pedestrian streets, and also the shops will be turned into new ones, and we will start to see all these global brands appear.
You mean like the private shopping centres?
Yeah.
Okay, so have you seen similarities in the three cities?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Geneva is a bit, it comes a bit slowlier because everything is a bit slowlier. I mean, people really take their time to change and turn things into something else. Toulouse, it's been for the last 5 years, and it went really fast. In the center of Toulouse now, there is only all the brands we know all around the world, and it's really as if we were in another city, really, not in Toulouse anymore. And so the problem for the people, It's the rents, really. They can't afford to live in the center of the town anymore. So the metropolization phenomena is also a big part is to deal with the traffic and the transportation. So because the people working in the city during the day are excluded in the outskirts and the suburbs, so the city council as to rethink about the public transportation network. And then that brings the street to look all the same, quite. And because the metropolitan is more an economic phenomena than anything else, really. It's a kind of, leveling all the cities to make them all.
So they're losing some of their own individual character as part of this. I think, isn't that called globalization? Isn't it normal, natural? We have to expect that now.
Well, I don't know if we can. We have to expect it. I think that's the loss of the particularities is really something that we shouldn't accept.
So, for example, in Geneva, that you know really well, what sort of things have you been losing there?
I think we lost the Swiss culture. You know, this really peaceful way to live our lives, really to not to hurry, not to, you know, to take our time, really. And what we see at the moment is just like people, you know, bumping into each other because they are in a hurry every day and all day long with their phones on their mobiles on their hands, and that's it.
Another part of this is what you talked about, the global chains, because many of those businesses, even if you go back, say, 20, 30 years, may well have been locally owned businesses. We're now seeing franchises being the norm. So everything has become a franchise. In fact, I was talking to someone today and saying, well, look, don't you think you should put the price, a bit of a bigger sign on there, so then people can see how much it is and you might get more customers? He said, but it's a franchise. I can't change anything here. So have you seen that similar sort of thing going on in Toulouse and in Geneva too, the loss of small businesses, local businesses?
Completely, completely. When I arrived in Geneva 20 years ago, I mean, there were quite a few streets in the centre and there were old shops. So when I arrived there, I thought, oh, yeah, okay, I'm in a different place. I have to discover new things, which is good for the curiosity. I mean, it's one of the part of human nature, curiosity, to discover things. It triggers our interest and our interactions with other people, other culture. But nowadays, I mean, I can see the same shops from one end of the street to the other end.
Okay, well, some people call it the McDonaldization of the world. Yeah. So everything is becoming like the same and a franchise or whatever. If you take a step back, what's really going on here?
I think that there is a way to lead people just to act as consumers. It's a kind of indoctrination, really. And the political systems are mainly step aside of this system, of this, you know, what's going on. And it's all about economy. And I think that it's just like as if a part of the human race or the human beings are completely lobotomized, you know, and we just have to consume things. We don't exist if we don't consume.
You know what? It's almost like a religion. And maybe the shopping centres, the private, big private shopping centres are like the new churches.
Well, I hope not. What I know is in Switzerland, there is still a kind of slow down movement, and we have one big brand at least, and they're building shopping malls, but they have another way of doing it. They own the place and they also choose different type of shops which might be more local, which I don't seem to lose.
Well, I was in Singapore recently, and the way they do things there is that they do have these big malls, but they make a very big point of making sure that there's plenty of space for small businesses, local people to also ply their trade right in the centre. I mean, even Singapore Airport, you know, there's a whole floor devoted to eateries, none of which are one of these franchises. They're all just run by local people. So I think what you're saying is we seem to be losing this in Europe, probably the same in North America too, this understanding that we have to make space, civic space, for these small people. Anyway, look, I'm interested because you've just come from Toulouse, haven't you, where we've got this Yellow Jacket protest going on in France. We're not getting necessarily all the truth about what the protests are about over here. We hear on the news something about the price of fuel is too high. Now, I don't think that's all this is about. So maybe you could just tell us what your experience was in Toulouse and what you think's really going on in France at the moment.
Yeah, what I know is that the movement started more than 2 months ago, and you know, in France, really, you know, old France. And not because the price of the fuel was too high, because the government wanted to raise the taxes on the fuel and petrol and diesel. So what people started to feel is like they need their car. So they need the petrol to go to work. So it's not fair to have more taxes on that, just to you know, fill the banks and fill the government's pocket money, really. So they started to demonstrate about that, and little by little, but they were in the outskirts of the towns, really, in the roundabouts and in the major motorways entries, and so they were just like slowing down the traffic to raise people's awareness about that. But little by little, there were other reivindications that started to say, okay, yeah, it's a national movement. So we have also things to say, like for the nurses, for example. And what I saw in Toulouse, and that was the first person I heard in the street when I was there last weekend, the nurses, I mean, they are going to cut the budget in the hospital. So actually, there is one nurses for 5 or 7 patients in the hospital, and because of the cut downs, there will be just one nurses for something like 15 or 20 patients, which is just too much. I mean, how can they care about the people, and if there are so less in the hospitals? And then along, you know, the march, what I saw is also something a bit surprising, like Frexit. So people thinking that, you know, France in the EU pays too much, or it's a burden, really, now. They don't get anything from that. And also,
I think maybe the euro has been, a lot of the French have been complaining about the euro, saying that when it was introduced 20 years ago, everything got more expensive immediately. And now it's becoming less and less purchase power, and they've got less euros in their pocket.
Yeah, definitely.
So anything else on the march? Was it peaceful, violent? What, you know, what did you see?
I mean, the first 2 hours were really, really peaceful. I mean, people were singing, people were just like really expressing themselves, but in a very quiet way. I mean, they were just marching. And after 2 hours, I mean, the police forces were there, and they were fully equipped, really. That was the first time of my life I've seen that, and I felt really a bit weird about it. It's as if the police was just here to assault us and not to defend us. And, you know, so it's
almost like a kind of paramilitary type thing.
Completely. So then after 2 hours, and it was on the big square in Toulouse, the Place du Capitole, and the people were really gathering there, but it was very quiet. But the problem is that there were almost 10,000 people, and suddenly the police force probably saw that it was too much. And one did react very badly, very strongly, and then it started.
One police?
Yeah, one police. I mean, it's not really the police, it's what we call the CRS. So they are special force, trained for that, you know, special demonstration.
Riot control.
Yeah. And so they started, there was a group of them, just like very close to the crowd, which was not threatening them or anything, but they did react to something, and then it started to shift in very and to
digit. Now the police will probably say, "Oh well, the demonstrators started something against us." So what actually happened? What was the police shooting tear gas or trying to arrest people or what?
Yeah.
And if so, what were they being arrested for?
Well, the arrestations came later on. I mean, the first thing was like, tear gas all around. I mean, it was like completely...
Was it sudden?
That was really, really sudden, yeah. Because within 2 minutes, I mean, the place was, I mean, the square was completely blank, full of smoke, within 1 or 2 minutes. And then the people started to escape that and to reform the march a bit further. So they continued it, really. And on one of the big avenues close to the square, so they were forming a march again and marching. But then suddenly the police was there again and bombing and tear gas again. And then, you know, people were starting to...
So the police are bombing and tear gassing, but... Yeah. The march, were they being violent themselves? I mean, were they smashing up anything at the time?
No, so not at the time. I mean, people were trying or to escape or to really just like stay there and stay really in solidarity and quiet. And what was the most amazing thing for me at that moment is that on these big avenues, I mean, the police was bombing and firing tear gas. And there were not only marchers, I mean, people here to revendicate, there were also a lot of people doing their shopping. And the people doing their shopping were just like going out of the shops and with their shopping bags. And, you know, it was really, I mean, how can the police, you know, do that with people around? I mean, the normal crowd.
I mean, what do you think the reaction of ordinary shoppers was to see something like that? Do you think they are they more likely to think, well, what are these demonstrators doing here? Can they just go away? We want to carry on our shopping. Or do you think their reaction is more rather annoyed about what the police are up to?
Well, at the beginning, people were really at the beginning of the demonstration, because it was quiet, people doing their shopping were just asking questions. Why are you here and what do you want? And so there was a friendly and a kind of very interesting talks going on between the people shopping and the people marching, really. But when it started to shift, I mean, people doing their shopping were trying to escape, just that, you know, they were really scared, and the shop starts to close. But there was not a lot of, I mean, usually there's people breaking the glasses and everything, and I didn't see much of that. But then as the police became more violent as well, and they started to hurt people and to, you know, some of the people demonstrating started to erect some barricades, which is quite a French word, but, you know, it's a French tradition as well.
Well, I think what the French like to do is they like to get a bus or something and push it over, turn it over, set fire to it, and then that really makes sure that the road can't really be used in a normal way anymore. Mm. This is their way of saying the situation is not normal today.
Yeah.
How do you think this is going to go, this protest? Any ideas? Do you think, I mean, you know, the various demands quite clearly focused on Macron, mm-hmm. and saying, well, this guy's not working for us. Mm-hmm. I don't know who he's working for necessarily, but he's not working for us. We want him gone, someone else. Do you think they'll get their way?
It's difficult to say because the government changed not long ago, and the prime minister is, you know... a kind of politician like belonging to the party of, you know, the old Republican Party, like UMP, it's called, and it's they have this heritage of right wing, like Jacques Chirac, and also. So, usually when they are there, they are there to stay, and they don't want to. They don't want to give up, really. So I don't know if they will have. I don't know if they will gain that. But what they're asking for is a citizen referendum, which is also the thing that makes me very interested in the movement. Because in Switzerland, we have the referendum. It's kind of automatic response to from the people when, you know, there's a decision from the government that we don't agree with. We automatically can organize a referendum.
So the French have been looking to Switzerland and saying, come on, let's have some of this.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think they'll get it?
I think it would be a very good thing. And I think that, I hope they will, because this is a very good way to govern a country, to offer to the people a way, a legal way, to express their no. Otherwise, you know, when people demonstrate and that turns into riots, and that is not normal.
But I mean, in England, in Britain, we've had this referendum for Brexit, haven't we? I'm not sure if the politicians are going to agree with it. So that's like a once in a lifetime thing. We don't really get referenda here in the UK. So that you think is a good, healthy thing that you've seen in Switzerland?
Yes, it is. But it's also because Switzerland is a smaller country. And also the way it is built politically as a confederation. The thing works a lot differently than in England or in UK or in France.
Now, I mean, looking at the Yellow Jacket protests, I don't think such a thing is likely to happen in England or in Britain. I just think there's a difference in character between the British and the French. Someone might call me a racist for saying that, and I don't care, really. But would you agree? Do you think the French are more prepared to do something like come out on the streets and demonstrate?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I think that one of the songs and one of the shouts I heard when I was in the street is that the street belongs to us. Basically, really, la rue est à nous. So one of the way, and it might be cultural, really, one of the way of French people to express their disagreements is that, okay, they take the street. They really take the streets. And I don't know. I mean, it doesn't happen that much in Switzerland, for sure. And it happens in another kind of way. You know, we don't have the right to strike. It's forbidden. And the demonstrations are only on the Saturdays or Sundays because we can't just, like, quit our job to demonstrate. And it's, of course, it happens locally, and because all these cantons have a lot of powers, so they can just manage with a small amount of population, which stays at a small scale. And things are going faster, the dialogue between the government, the canton, and the people is going faster. It's more direct, I would say.
Bristol, we've talked a lot about Geneva and Toulouse. What's your impressions of Bristol in comparison?
That's interesting, because what I saw since I arrived, and I've never seen that in Bristol before, is like there is small groups getting organized, and especially around the topic of free spaces. And I saw that yesterday, and a kind of slogan saying that a city without free spaces is like a circus without a clown. And so people are revendicating for these free spaces where they can have some alternatives for social gathering and cultural happenings and performances and things like that. So these are small groups, but as far as I can see till now, they get quite well organized. And they're really fighting for, they're really willing to keep these free spaces in the town, trying to slow down maybe the gentrification process, which will be at one point probably will be stuck for by the private property and private owners. They probably won't be very happy to see that. But yeah, they're getting organized, which is a good thing.
Well, I look forward to your film once it's finished, but maybe you could just finish by telling us something about some previous filmmaking you've done and maybe where, if people can find that, some of your films online.
Yeah. So the first full-length documentary was about something a bit similar, you know. It was about urban community gardens. So how can people gather and recreate a local life while gardening together? So I went to Lincoln and I went to Lisbon as well and San Francisco and different places like that. And yeah, I had a good experience in all these kind of urban garden where people recreate a sense of community.
But is it in English?
There is an English version, okay, which is online on my Vimeo page, and it's called Gardens of Hope.
Okay. Marie-Luce Storm, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks to you, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Ron Mandel. I'm still a senior lecturer at the University of Northampton, although I officially retired from teaching. I'm supervising a PhD student who's doing his thesis on the connection between politics and religion in Pakistan.
What subject?
International relations, okay, and politics. I moved to Bristol 4 months ago. I'm an exile from the United States, 32 years removed. Left New York City to be with a woman who I met in New York City, and we had a transatlantic relationship for 2 years, well before Skype and WhatsApp and, you know, internet. They said if Muhammad doesn't go to the mountain goes to Muhammad. So I was the mountain, and I moved to be with my future wife.
I know you had conversations with your father many years ago back in New York about the, well, I suppose genocide, really, of the Native Americans. I mean, how do you translate that onto what's going on in the modern world?
Well, genocide is, it's a term that is too loosely used. Obviously, we can talk about suppression of people's human rights, the denial of their claim basically to human security, and it's not unique to what happened to the Native Americans 200 years ago.
But that was pretty extensive, wasn't it? I mean, it I think we're talking about something like 50 million.
Yeah, we're talking about the, you know, ethnic cleansing basically is a term that's often used. Often people talk about transportation of Africans to the Caribbean, to North America, where they were enslaved, is basically possibly being, you know, a precursor to the Holocaust, basically, because the number of people who died as a result of people who suffered. But I try not to use those terms too loosely. My interests in the whole issue of human rights is not just an academic one, you know, because I've taught international relations for a number of years, and I've talked about you know, the question of humanitarian intervention and how that was being misused by Western powers basically to overthrow governments which they found incompatible with Western interests. But since I moved to Bristol, I've been very active in the Palestine Museum. It's a museum that's located in Broad Street. It's only open on weekends, Saturday and Sunday, and I volunteered there. And I met a number of other volunteers, about 25 volunteers, very committed people. And my interest in Palestine is an interesting one because I think as a Jew, I've had a personal journey to break away from this kind of knee-jerk reaction to seeing any criticism of Israel as being anti-Semitic and basically feeling that Jews have to be Zionists. So it's been a long journey for me where I've been kind of questioning the relationship between a Jewish identity and believing in a Zionist ideology.
I mean, surely the Zionist ideology is simply based around, I mean, what people like Netanyahu would say, it's all based around the Old Testament.
Well, the Old Testament. Well, I'm not quite sure about the Old Testament, but that's the ultra-nationalist interpretation, of basically, of the greater Israel. It doesn't recognize the Palestinians' claim to even being on that land. And that ignores 4,000 years of history because the Palestinians were cohabiting with the Israelites going back well before even Christ was even around. I don't accept that. The Zionist ideology has almost become a kind of a civic religion now in Israel. Anyone who questions it is ostracized and damned. Jews coming from the United States, there's kind of it's called Birthright. They organize tours. Israeli government organizes tours to go to Israel for American Jews. And there were three young people who were kicked off the tour because they asked the tour guide what the wall was about. They had been driving by the wall three or four times, and the tour guide didn't even mention it. And the students, the young people, actually asked the guide what it was there for. And he took exception to it because he felt that basically they had a hidden agenda and they were kicked off the tour. It just makes me feel that you cannot even question Israeli practices without feeling that you're being disloyal and being traitorous to your people. And there's a very long tradition of secular Jews basically questioning Zionist principles.
Isn't it almost pointless to question Zionism nowadays because the majority of the people in Israel are Jewish? So it's happened. Why is the point of questioning it?
You question it because the Zionist doctrine is based on a land without a people, right? And a people without a land. And the fact is, it's made the indigenous people invisible. To give you an example, in May 2018, to celebrate the creation of the State of Israel, Israeli students were marching through East Jerusalem, which is basically where the Palestinians live. And there was one ringleader who was interviewed on Al Jazeera, and he was asked, what about the Palestinians? What do you think the Palestinians are going to make of this? And he said, there are no Palestinians. They don't exist. They're Arabs. So the self-determination of the Jewish people for a state is predicated on dispossessing, all right, the rights of Palestinians and denying them equal rights. I think there is a scope to question Zionism.
So don't you think Jews deserve a homeland?
I believe any people have a claim, a right to security, all right? There's no denying that Israel is there to stay, all right? But increasingly, there is a movement now to recognize that there has to be equal rights for Palestinians within a state. I don't know what it's going to call the State of Israel. I don't know if it will be renamed but there has to be a constitutional arrangements to recognize the equality of the Palestinians and Israelis and to live together. And I think there is a movement among the Palestinians actually to do that.
Benjamin Netanyahu has brought in his nation state law in 2018, which many people say is actually a racist law. It's discriminating very much against Arab people, against Palestinian people. Doesn't really give them proper rights as citizens anymore, and certainly discriminates against them. But he's a very, very successful politician. You do get the sense, certainly if you watch the TV over here, that's what the Jewish people, that's what the Israeli people want. They want someone like that.
Well, I think politically, the discourse in Israel now has moved much more to the right. To give you a chilling example, when the Palestinians were approaching the fence separating Gaza from the state of Israel. I think it was May 14th. I think it might have been the same day that the U.S. embassy in Israel was opened in Jerusalem. About 80 Palestinians were killed. Not one TV, not one radio station, only one newspaper, Haaretz, actually covered the story. Most Israelis don't even know what's happening in Gaza and West Bank. All they see is the Palestinians being potential terrorists, and we have to be protected from them. So it's a very chilling reality. I think there are Israelis, though, who are dissidents, who are questioning the whole Israeli policies and practices as we speak. But they are a tiny minority. But they're holding their own and trying basically to hold Israel accountable for their behavior.
To me, what you're saying is there's some sort of media conspiracy by the Israeli government or people sympathetic to them to keep this off the agenda.
I don't know if it's a conspiracy or not, but basically I don't think they don't see the Palestinians as being important. They accept the logic of of the settlements, the expansion of Israel, and they don't recognize the rights of Palestinians. I don't think it's a conspiracy. I think it's more they've kind of internalized the whole logic of Zionism, and unfortunately at the expense of Palestinians.
I suppose there is also self-censorship, isn't it? I mean, people think to themselves, well, my editor won't be interested in this story, so we're just not interested in ourselves. There's no point in covering something if the editor's then going to spike it.
That's exactly right. And there's no readership for it, exactly. And at the end of the day, you're in the industry, and you're a business, and basically you got to survive.
And you've got to make sure your advertisers don't phone up the next day and say,
exactly.
Right.
Exactly. We're pulling investments because
you're... No car ads for the next 6 months.
That's exactly right.
I mean, this does happen, doesn't it? The future, though, I wonder if you can see any sort of chinks of light in the end of the tunnel, because it does look grim. I mean, there's a quite clearly a war brewing of some sort, whether it happens or not, is anyone's guess, between Iran and Israel, with Syria kind of sandwiched in the middle there somewhere. And it seems that we had Netanyahu last year, the Israeli prime minister, next to the nuclear base Dimona, pounding his chest and saying, look, we can hit Iran anytime we want. And although he didn't say it, he's implying that they could nuke Iran if they wanted to anytime.
Well, I think you're hitting a very interesting point, actually, and it's a powder keg. And it's hard to say what will set it off. The relations between Iran and Israel right now are probably the worst they ever have been. And the United States obviously has demonized Iran. And the United States has formed an alliance with Saudi Arabia and Israel basically to isolate Iran. I'm not quite sure if Israel will move against Iran, because Iran has been playing resources very cleverly, because they've been trying to reach understanding with Turkey and Russia. So I'm not quite sure if Israel will unilaterally act. They would probably only do so with the blessing of the United States, to be honest with you.
Well, this is the next question. The United States doesn't really seem to have any particular important strategic interest in being so supportive of Israel. Why is the U.S. so supportive of what Israel does?
Well, I think I just mentioned it, because strategically, Israel serves a very important interest to the United States. If the United States is worried about Iran's influence, it's in Iraq and Syria and elsewhere. Iran wants to build this link.
But why is the United States worried about Iran? I mean, it's the other side of the world almost.
Well, because they see Iran basically as a thorn in the side of U.S. interests.
I suppose it's oil, is it, maybe?
It could be oil, it could be gas, and the United States also is very keen basically in not allowing Iran to form an alliance with Iraq and Syria and Lebanon, which could threaten its not only political but economic interests.
Is there any way, do you think, that Britain, as it was before the Second World War, in America after the Second World War, will just turn their back on the Middle East and get on with their own affairs, rather than, because there seems to be interventions from Britain and America for the last 100 years?
Well, I don't know about Britain. Britain is a minor player in the Middle East, really. I think at the end of the day, it's the United States calls the shots, basically. Even the EU which has a support for a two-state solution, as does the United States on paper and Britain, basically. I think we've only been going through the motions because there's been no pressure put on Israel, basically, to negotiate in good faith with the Palestinian leadership. I don't think Britain is going to be a major player. The one interesting thing you could say, if a Labour government comes into power with Corbyn as leader, there will possibly be a shift in foreign policy, because I think you could see Britain coming out in support of Palestinian rights much more explicitly.
How powerful is the Israel lobby in Britain and America?
Very powerful.
How does it operate?
It operates not only officially in terms of groups that are recognized as lobbyists, but the lobby basically has support among informally among Jewish groups. For example, I'll just give you another. In California, Angela Davis was supposed to be awarded something in recognition by the Civil Rights Institute in California.
So who's she?
Angela Davis was an African-American leader in the late 1960s and 70s, and has written on black feminism, and she was a member of the Communist Party at one stage, and then left after the Communist Party basically fell apart, after the Soviet Union collapsed. And Jewish groups in California put pressure on the Institute to withdraw the invitation. So she's now been denied being recognized as being an advocate of civil rights. And her statement was very interesting. She said, I don't take this personally. I don't think it's undermining me, but it's basically undermining all those who are fighting for social justice. You have in universities attempts basically to silence anyone who criticizes Israel. There are 26 states in the United States which have passed or are considering passing laws to prohibit the advocacy of boycott, disinvestment, and sanctions. 26 states.
Amazing.
And even in Congress right now, there is some discussion of passing a law to criminalize BDS.
Well, that's the precise campaign which was so successful in South Africa.
That's exactly right. So that's how the lobby works. The lobby works. The lobby, in some sense, is not, it's not a conspiracy. It's basically it's getting the word out that certain things are off limits, certain things are illegitimate, and you have a consensus, unfortunately, within the both parties, Democrats and Republicans, maybe with a few exceptions of Democrats, who see Israel basically as being a beacon of democracy, but the outpost of civilization in the Middle East, and we'll never question Israel.
Now, I've read a few articles the last couple of months, a couple comparing the whole 1950s McCarthyism, are you a communist? Have you ever been a member of a communist party? To the way that anti-Semitism is being treated nowadays. Is that something that you think that's a bit of a comparison too far, or is that...
No, I think that's an apt analogy. I think that's very insightful, actually. And it's a way of silencing people. People who put their heads above the parapet and just questioning the practices of a state and holding them accountable to international conventions and international law, and basically trying to cow them. And anyone who basically advocates BDS is seen to be anti-Semitic. And I don't see that as, I think you could be, there's a very strong Jewish tradition. I remember going to Hebrew school. I went to Hebrew school for 3 years in the United States. And we were always told that we had a moral duty to speak out against social injustice, no matter where we saw it and no matter who was perpetuating it. So there's a very strong ethical and moral tradition within Judaism, which I hold dear. So I don't see there's any contradiction in being a Jew and being critical of Israel. And as a Jew, I could say that. And I could say there are Christians, likewise, the Judeo-Christian tradition, who likewise basically be compelled to speak out against injustice. And I don't see that as being anti-Semitic.
What about the confusion, you might call it, between the Jewish identity as a racial thing and as a religion? Because I think for some people that is difficult to untangle. The two seem to be mixed together somehow.
That's exactly right. And I think the turning point, because if you look at the history or the evolution of Zionism, Zionism was a minor undercurrent within the Jewish communities, both in this country and the United States, until after the Holocaust. The Holocaust basically was the turning point. Until the Holocaust, most Jews were assimilating or acculturating in the societies they lived in. The immigrants who came from Russia and Eastern Europe to this country, the United States, they adopted new homelands, whether it be Britain or the United States, and they settled. You know, and they thought themselves as being British or American. The Holocaust was the turning point, because then Zionism attains kind of the higher terrain, basically, and gains legitimacy.
At the same time, it got land too.
That's exactly right. Exactly. So now, I think you're quite right. Most Jews were identified with the State of Israel. So it's very tricky, and this is really difficult, to separate out the Jewish identity from the State of Israel. Because for many Jews who are secular, they're not religious, right? They strongly identify with Israel because they see that as basically a source of pride, a source of empowerment, a source of security and so forth. So it's very difficult to kind of separate those things out. I don't see being a Jew a nationality. You know, Judaism is a religion, you know? So I don't see...
But you talk about yourself as Jewish.
Yes.
Are you religious? You go to synagogue every Saturday?
No. You know, I followed Ernest Hemingway's, adage. You know, when he was a devout Catholic, and he said, "If you're a Catholic, and either you practice Catholicism or you break altogether." And it's the same thing as a Jew. I went to synagogue for 3 years. You know, my mother kept a kosher home, but I broke from it. You know, but again, it's still part of my cultural, DNA. You know, you can't simply just disavow everything that you were,
wouldn't necessarily want to. There are certain parts of it you want to hang on to.
Okay? Exactly.
What about the future? Because we already talked about the potential war in the Middle East, but there's a very powerful movement within the Zionist community, which is talking about the Third Temple, rebuilding the Temple in Jerusalem. Now, obviously that, for a Zionist, is a major achievement. Now, they're talking about, we just heard last year, moving the American embassy to Jerusalem. All these things are towards rebuilding some kind of religious Jewish state. And that, the only problem with that is you've got the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the same site. So this is obviously potentially quite provocative.
Highly provocative, And you can even argue that, Jerusalem was supposed to be an international city. As part of the recognition of the State of Israel, when the United Nations decided to do so in 1948, was that Jerusalem was supposed to be a place where Christians, Muslims, and Jews basically could worship and cohabit. It was not supposed to be claimed by any one nation.
Well, for centuries it was, actually.
Yeah, and Israel had to accept that as a condition. And when they attempted, I think in 1981, basically, to try to annex Jerusalem, they were stopped by the United Nations Security Council. So I think Trump's move, I think, is highly provocative, and it's given more fuel to basically the Israelis, the ultra-nationalists, basically, to do exactly what you're saying, which I think is highly, not only provocative, but incendiary. You know, it could set off, conflicts between Palestinians and Israelis on the ground.
Likud leader Benjamin Netanyahu, prime minister, going through some political difficulties right now, several potential criminal prosecutions for bribery, that sort of thing. And also now he's had people pull out of his coalition, so there's going to be a general election in Israel in the next couple of months. Do you think that could be the end for him, or is he going to come storming back?
I think he's a cat with nine lives, he's a survivor, and he's a very skilled politician. And I think, going back to the question you asked before about the Israeli population supporting the project, I think he has his fingers on the pulse. I will not be surprised if he wins re-election in April, assuming he's not found guilty of the charges that have been brought against him by April. But I think the way the wheels of justice move in Israel, I don't think that's going to happen.
And what will that mean for the future? Because it will be almost an endorsement of somebody who's just about managed to survive, and you know, politically, and also who's been. It may even encourage him to introduce more separatist policies, more racist policies.
Well, I think so. There's no effective opposition to him. The right-wing parties are too splintered. I think they're basically forging another government and possibly a big coalition government at a price, again, for the Palestinians. The Palestinians would pay dearly for it. There'd be more settlements. There'd be more entrenchment of, you know, racist legislation denying Palestinian rights. I hate to be a pessimist, but I think you might be right.
Now, Ron, a lot of people listening might be thinking to themselves, I would imagine they'll be thinking, well, why don't we get this sort of discussion on the mass media, you know, what we've been chatting about now. Are there any places you think people can go either online or other places to actually keep up with what's going on? Because we do seem to get quite a biased coverage in our national media about what's going on in Israel.
Well, the only reliable source in terms of media, I think, is Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera has been very balanced in their views. They interview Palestinian spokespersons. They interview Israeli spokespersons, and they give coverage to what's happening. And there are other sources, online sources called Mondo Weiss, which is comes out of the United States, which produces articles both from Israelis and secular Jews and others. Who are questioning Israeli practices.
So I'll put links up to those on our show page. Interestingly, we had Al Jazeera up until a couple of years ago, Al Jazeera English on Freeview in this country, then suddenly, pop, one day I switched it on, it's gone.
That's a shame.
I know. It's crazy, isn't it?
Well, I subscribe to Virgin, so I still get it. I don't know why it's not on Freeview. That's really strange.
Yeah. It just disappeared. Anyhow, Ron Mendel, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Marie-Luce Storm, a Swiss filmmaker, and university lecturer and writer Ron Mendel. Also to studio engineers Dave Bazanko and Joss Chivers. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft. If you have some spare time, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
it's not the way that you say it when you do those things to me. It's more the way that you mean it when you tell me what will be. And when you stop and think about it, you won't believe it's true that all the love you've been giving has all been meant for you. I'm looking for someone to change my life. I'm looking for a miracle in my life. And if you could see what it's done to me, lose the love I knew could save me through. Between the silence of the mountains and the crashing of the sea, there lies a land I once lived in, and she's waiting there for me. But in the gray of the morning, my mind becomes confused between the dead and the sleeping and the road that I must choose. I'm looking for someone to change my life. I'm looking for a miracle in my life. And if you could see what it's done to me, to lose the love I knew, could safely lead me to the land that I once knew. The land as we grow old, the secrets of our soul. You say it when you do those things to me. It's more the way you really mean it when you tell me what will be.